It's so clear that the United States is trying to sell a war.
The American people ought to be aware of the way government operates. It will do everything it can to hide from its people what its motives really are.
The genocidal policies of the United States government is still continuing, and it's going worldwide.
I really do think that it's a mistake for the press and the media to focus excessively on this one subject.
Columbus inaugurated the depopulization of the Americas, which would later in years be described as conquest and ultimately give birth to the phrase manifest destiny.
On this Columbus Day holiday, many see little to celebrate and find a connection between the New World conquerings of long ago and plans to attack Iraq by President Bush. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On this day that American hegemony celebrates the arrival of Christopher Columbus to the Americas, a man who represents the horrific mass destruction of entire New World societies, KPFK correspondent Fidel Rodriguez spoke with David E. Stannard, author of American Holocaust, The Conquest of the New World. They spoke of President George W. Bush's and Christopher Columbus's concept of who is civilized and how many indigenous people have died in the American Holocaust.
Last week, George Bush Jr. had an address regarding his case for creating a war with Iraq. He concluded in his speech by stating that the United States and all nations that America speaks with one voice and is determined to make the demands of the civilized world mean something. Is his concept of civilized the same type of concept and understanding of what Columbus, you know, thought was civilized?
Absolutely perfect. I mean, in fact, let's go back to Columbus again for a minute. I mentioned earlier that there was a debate in Spain, including a very famous, very formal debate that took place about what were these people who the Spanish were conquering and killing. And there was a very formal justification of the killing of those people by repeating stories, again, fabricated stories, that they're cannibals, that in some cases that they have the heads of dogs, on some of these islands, that they're really beasts and so on and so forth. They're demonized. And once you demonize the people, then you're justified, so the logic goes, in slaughtering them. And again, it comes, that's what clearly is going on here, this distinction between the so-called civilized world, and the opposite of that, rarely do you hear the opposite, the so-called uncivilized. That goes without saying. That's implied in the statement. But we, again, had that happen during the Gulf War. All sorts of stories, frankly, I can't recall now at the end of American Holocaust, I talk about some of them, but the language that was used by the American military to describe Iraqi women as whores and so on and so forth, it's a way of immunizing yourself against your own conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on here. I mean, you know, the normal human beings, I am optimistic enough to believe, don't really care to engage in genocide. They don't care to engage in, even if it's not genocide, mass slaughter of innocent people. Only psychopaths do that. Like these guys or a guy who's shooting people in Maryland.
Right.
Normal people have to find a justification, and the justification becomes that these people are evil, that they're threatening to you, and that they are somehow also a contaminated kind of people. There's something wrong with them, fundamentally wrong with them, maybe borderline human. And, you know, we're more sophisticated in the way we do that nowadays than they were 500 years ago, but the process is pretty much the same.
The same. Right.
By the time the bombs start falling in Iraq, by the time the soldiers, if it comes to that, the American soldiers, troops are going through the streets of Baghdad killing people, rest assured, the American media and the American political operators will have convinced Americans that somehow this is just side and that the people deserve their fate. Mm. And that's part of what that little line you just recited to me about the civilized world is all about.
Definitely. Well, Mr. Standard, before we get out of here, I just want to ask you one last question.
Okay.
Has the genocide in the Americas really ceased?
No, it has not. Again, just as in the 15th century or the 16th century, it was being carried out differently in South America and in what is now the United States, it continues today differently in those different places. For example, in Guatemala, during the 1980s, an enormous percentage, a huge proportion of the indigenous population was either openly slaughtered or, as they call it, disappeared. Huge, 200,000 people wiped out. That campaign, which the United States was deeply involved, although the blood directly was on the hands of the local junta, that campaign was very, very, very similar structurally to what happened 500 years ago. In the United States, it's different. We don't usually launch those kinds of campaigns. What we do is, there are two ways of killing large numbers of people. One is to directly slaughter them. The other is to simply prohibit them from having assistance in facing the everyday challenges of life. And that's what we've done to the indigenous peoples of north of the United States and Canada.
Right.
We push them onto reservations and then give them a choice. You can either leave the reservation, lose your culture, live in urban ghettos, become a second or third or fourth class citizen, just like Puerto Ricans and Chicanos and African Americans and so on and so forth, or you can stay on the reservation and hold on to what is left of your culture. But in the meantime, you will have no plumbing, you will have inadequate food, you will have shelter that barely keeps the cold out, you will have no medical care, and so on and so forth. So you will die much, much younger than the rest of the population, than the white population. And if you lopped 10 years off the average life expectancy of any group of people, you are, in effect, committing genocide against those people. You're preventing lives from being lived. And that's what we're doing in our own tasteful way in the United States these days.
You know, real quick, too, Mr. Standard, what's a good working number that we can talk about in terms of indigenous that were wiped out during this American Holocaust?
Well, my guess is if you go to the normal, if you take the entire two figures, one, since we're in the United States,
right?
United States, and another one for the whole Western Hemisphere. The whole Western Hemisphere, there are estimates that the original population was over 100 million. That's really not well established, I don't think, although it may have been, because the almost every estimate has traditionally been an underestimate. But let's say 75 million people,
okay.
I think, is a fairly safe number.
And that's not even including other ethnic groups that have suffered from this, in terms of Africans and
right.
You know, we're just
just the indigenous peoples of the hemisphere, somewhere in excess of 75 million people.
Okay,
reduced down ultimately to somewhere in the vicinity of 8 million or so.
All right.
In the United States, again, figure. If there were, say, 12 to 15 million indigenous people originally, at the time of the first European arrival, by the end of the 19th century, there were only 250,000 left. So you're talking about a population, a destruction of 95 to 99% of the population.
David E. Standard, author of American Holocaust, The Conquest of the New World, speaking with producer Fidel Rodriguez of Pacifica Station KPFK. Creating a more politically accurate accounting of the travels of Christopher Columbus is a mandate for many historians. Ambrose Lane Sr. is author of Return of the Buffalo and For Whites Only, How and Why America Became a Racist Nation. Lane says we're becoming the colonial power in the world. Columbus was trying to find some wealth for his patrons, and Bush is trying to control the wealth of the Middle East for his father's patrons.
What happened, it was very simple. Those nations that had the most powerful armies and navies were able to overrun and rule and kill and steal from all of those countries that had no such military. Spain, by the year 1609, had raped and plundered all of the southern hemisphere, especially the Americas, and had garnered for itself something like $6 billion and was, at that time, the richest nation on earth and also the most powerful nation on earth because of its massive navy. They lost that in the mid-1600s, beginning about 1588 when they decided to invade England. And England had a puny navy, but they had faster ships, lighter ships, and cannons that could shoot farther. So when the invincible Armada of Spain invaded England in 1588, they got the shock of their lives. The result was they had 130 ships, 30,000 troops, 3,000 cannons, and 90 executioners because they were going to execute the Queen, Queen Elizabeth. And when they left there, they had lost 20,000 of those 30,000 men, and England had only lost fewer than 100. And in the next 3 years, Spain lost 800 of its ships. Now compare that to the United States of America. We now are the richest, most powerful nation on earth. And the reason you see our leaders putting so much money into defense and into weaponry is because of the example posed by Spain in the 1500s and 1600s. Spain lost everything. That's reading it's a puny example of a nation today because of what happened then.
Now, as much of the country is taking today to celebrate the holiday of Columbus Day, some political analysts see a connection between what Spain and Columbus did and what our present-day government is attempting to do in Iraq. Is that a stretch on your part?
No, it isn't. All colonial powers do the same thing. They're about the business of acquiring land and the riches underneath the land. And they will use their massive, more powerful armies, navies, and in this instance, Air Force, in order to steal, in order to convert all of the wealth that they can find on land or under land for their own people. And they will kill massively. We have no problem with killing. And no colonial power ever has had any problem in killing. Of course, we have adopted a new term for all those who are non-combatants who are killed.
But now to take that position basically dismisses summarily the justification or the rationale that the Bush administration has put forward in terms of its reasons for wanting to invade Iraq on the basis of the fact that Iraq may actually have chemical or biological weapons of mass destruction that could eventually be used against this country.
If Iraq still has those weapons of mass destruction, they were supplied by the United States of America. This country, during the Reagan-Bush years, sent 70 packages. And these are huge packages, from the Centers for Disease Control. And that's why they have anthrax. We gave it to them.
And what's the basis of that?
Well, the basis of that is a report that's been issued by our own government that admitted that we did that during the Reagan-Bush years. 70 times we sent them, and not only did we send them these weapons of mass destruction, but we enable them to more effectively use them against Iran and you know, they keep saying against his own people. It wasn't against his own people, it was against the Kurds. Mm-hmm. And we used our satellite so that we could tell Saddam Hussein where and when to dump those products on those people and kill them. Now, that's a matter of public record. And so when I hear him talking about it, I'm saying, when are you going to admit what we've done? There are government reports that have already said that the Centers for Disease, can you imagine that? The Centers for Disease Control sent 70 different packages of these products, including West Nile disease. And, you know, I didn't hear about West Nile disease until a few months ago. Mm-hmm. But we sent him West Nile disease so that he could produce it.
It does kind of harken back to the historical fact that the Native Americans were infected with smallpox from blankets that were distributed amongst the Native population.
No question about that.
Sort of an eerie connection.
We did that. The descendants of the Englishmen who came here after 1619, they knew what they brought because, you know, they not only brought they brought rats that were not native to this country and almost resulted in the starvation of one of the earliest groups of people who come here from England.
So when you start talking about chemical and biological weaponry in the context of Iraq, you'd be foolish not to make the link, or you'd be naive not to make the link.
And the talking heads of television should have been telling the American people what the truths are, and that we supplied Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was our associate, was a close associate of George Herbert Walker Bush when he was CIA director and when he was vice president and president.
Ambrose Lane, Sr., author of Return of the Buffalo and For Whites Only, How and Why America Became a Racist Nation. The American Indian Movement held a rally at the foot of a statue of Christopher Columbus in front of Union Station in Washington, D.C. Reem Kathuta from Pacifica Station WPFW was there and prepared this piece.
Or talking. Today marks the 510th anniversary of the invasion of the Americas by the Europeans.
Or talking. Strained from our ancestry.
When the pilgrims got off the boat at Plymouth Rock, it is said that they fled the countries of their origins to escape from spiritual, cultural, social, economic, and political persecution.
First Nation man, First Nation woman, this is not the time to weep. This is the time to seek a way out.
From the time they got off the boat, they've been waging war against people of peace throughout the world. And that continues today. What a tragedy that again in 2002, the same people are looking at the oil fields of Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, and have the arrogance to accuse other people throughout the world of state-sponsored terrorism.
That's right.
Of maybe developing biological weapons, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons of destruction. We have no proof that this is in fact the case in regards to Iraq. But we do have proof that these same people practice state-sponsored terrorism in first using smallpox biological warfare against the people of the eastern seaboard. Many tribes, more than half, were wiped out through state-sponsored terrorism and biological warfare. Those that survived were the victims of military aggression, psychological, physical terrorism, again behind the cross of Christ, led this crusade across the country. And again, I will say that claimed as many as 16 million of us.
No time to discuss Columbus' discovery, to talk about his story. First Nation man, First Nation woman. Time to powwow about how to regain the land. Cause there can be no justice on stolen land. No brotherhood with the white man. Unto the First Nation, regain the land.
Has its origins for us, and they continue to carry out terrorism against people of the world behind the guise of fighting terrorism. They commit terrorism on people to get at the oil fields of Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Libya in particular. Go to www.aimovement.org. Go to the Peltier file. This past week, we loaded hundreds of FBI, CIA, White House, Justice Department documents released under the Freedom of Information Act, which will show you the criminal actions of this government against the American Indian Movement and Leonard Peltier. This is a continuation of the American Holocaust that have claimed 100-some thousand victims, mostly Indian people in the country of El Salvador. The U.S. war against the people of Nicaragua has also claimed tens of thousands of victims.
Let the arrows of freedom fly.
I don't want to trivialize the deaths of innocent people at the World Trade Center. I don't want to trivialize the death of innocent people at the Pentagon. But let me tell you this, my friends. While this was happening, the United States was bombing and killing Afghanistani people. They were bombing and still are bombing Iraq every day, carrying out these crimes against humanity in Guatemala. Since 1954, perhaps 300,000 Guatemalans have lost their lives. It makes pale what happened at the World Trade Center, the deaths of innocent civilians in Guatemala in particular.
500 years of tears have not washed away the memories.
Incidentally, I should tell you this. During the height of the murders of people in Guatemala, George Bush the First, as head of the CIA and president of the United States, the deaths intensified 20-fold in that country.
From the east, from the west, from the north, from the south, shout! Let your voices be heard. Rise, warriors.
Vernon Bellecourt, founder of the American Indian Movement, John Steinbeck, a Gray Panther member and D.C. organizer, Chuck Kaufman, representing the Latin American Solidarity Coalition, all spoke at the event. A protest at the statue today led to the arrest of two demonstrators. That piece was prepared by Reem Kadhuta. With the advanced technology behind today's warfare, the American public has become increasingly more distracted from the horrors of war. Photographer Simon Norfolk spent 2 years in Afghanistan chronicling the aftermath of war. He spoke with KPFT News reporter Jackson Allers recently about his feelings of the U.S. war in Afghanistan and the Bush administration's impending war on Iraq.
Well, I quite like the fact that the way I photograph those things is with a camera that looks like it was built in the 1850s. And the camera that I use is made of wood and leather and brass, and it's a bit of kind of throwback.
That was Simon Norfolk, photographer of conscience, discussing the type of camera he uses to capture the landscapes of war's aftermath. Norfolk, whose first book was a study on the landscapes of genocide called For Most of It, I Have No Words, was in Afghanistan between 1999 and 2002. The following interview took place during the opening of Norfolk's Afghanistan Chronotopia exhibit at PhotoFest in Houston, Texas. Norfolk discusses his feelings on the consequences of war, the implications of war on those who would suffer from U.S. military aggression, and the reason he photographs these warscapes.
Why did you go to Afghanistan?
Because I was so against the war, because I thought the war was so wrong. When the Gulf War was fought, you know, I kind of turned out on the streets and went on demonstrations and got angry about it, and I kind of persuaded myself that if I did those things, somehow the war was stoppable. But what struck me about this war was utterly unstoppable. What I thought about it, absolutely irrelevant. Tony and George were going to do this thing, and I could set fire to myself in Whitehall. It's not going to stop the damn thing for 5 minutes. I never really felt so disenfranchised. And I thought the kind of parallel of that was the way the media covered it, in that the media coverage of the war was unbelievably sterile, unbelievably... There was never any kind of consequence of what this thing was. All you ever saw was an aircraft carrier in the Arabian Sea or a press conference in Florida or somewhere, and then if you saw the country of Afghanistan at all, it was this black and white footage shot from the nose cone of a F-16 or something. You never saw this place. Even during the war in Kosovo, you sometimes saw pictures of, you know, women cowering in staircases or injured children in hospitals and stuff. In this war, you never saw any of that. But what I think is interesting about that sterility is that I think it's democratically really, really dangerous if war is covered in that way, because it makes it just seem like a kind of computer game. I think that's what's really disturbing about the Afghan war, is that everyone said it's going to be like Vietnam, it's going to be a nightmare, thousands will get killed and stuff, and then that didn't happen. And I think people are just at the end of it, you know, the military in this country in particular sort of thought, sat down and went, well, that went rather well. Maybe we should do that again. Maybe we should do that more often, you know. Maybe next time we've got a problem, let's not bother with conventions or the UN or treaties or whatever. Let's just push some buttons on a computer somewhere in Florida and problem gone, you know. 16,000 feet, a man pushes a button in an airplane and problem over. So why do we bother with all this arguing with people and negotiating and treaties and compromise when we can just push some buttons and none of our airmen get killed and it, you know, didn't even cost us a lot? And I think that for all of us, that is a really dangerous position to get to, because war should be the option, should be the last option, not the first option. And it seems to be coming up the options list, particularly with the way George Bush is talking about Iraq now.
Speak to that a little. You basically framed it in the sense that you're talking about an administration that isn't waiting for the go-ahead by the international community.
No.
They're really...
driving it themselves.
Hell-bent to go to war.
Yeah.
How could photography prevent this?
Well, I can't really talk about the Iraq war, but what I thought about the Afghan war was that I couldn't stop the war, but what I can do is show what the war looks like. If you want to drop $4 billion worth of weapons on a place, you're going to leave some seriously big holes in it. And I can try and portray what that looks like, and that's what my photography is. It's about aftermath. I felt I couldn't do anything to stop the war. I couldn't even kind of dint its progress, but what I can do is say, well, it has a consequence, right? It has a human consequence, it has a physical consequence on the landscape. You just look at these buildings that are torn to pieces, you know what the human consequence of anyone that was anywhere near this thing at the time, and that these things are not a computer game. It's not remote, it's not sanitized, it's not sterile. It's human, and it's on the flesh, and it's about ripped apart flesh and dead people. And I can show that side of things. But what's unique about Afghanistan that I had never seen before is simply because the war has been going on so long, 24 years now, is that you can see these different eras of the combat. You can see these different periods of destruction. You can see when the main kind of tactic of battle was Soviet armored cars and tanks. And you can see when they left and it turned to the Mujahideen warlords fighting amongst each other, where the biggest weapon they had was probably RPGs and Kalashnikovs, and the buildings were destroyed in a different way. And now you can see the American bombardment, where they dropped quite a small number of munitions, but they were just colossal. 2,000-pounder laser-guided bombs. These are enormous hole in a thing, and creates these very kind of weird shapes and forms in the landscape. You'll have to find a building that's on either side, buildings completely intact, with even their windows and their curtains in, and between them, a building vaporized, just a hole where a building has been. And so you could see these different layers in Afghanistan, and it was like walking through Kabul in particular, is like walking through a museum of the archaeology of war, because these different kind of like traces are left behind. Just like when you look at the rings of a tree, you can see a wet winter and a dry summer and a spring with disease. In walking through Afghanistan, you can see a place that was destroyed by Kalashnikovs only, or a place that was destroyed by 2,000-pound laser-guided bomb. Societies are built around this kind of membrane which sits between ordinary society and war, and through that membrane we pass cash and technological brilliance and our best sons and daughters, and not a lot really comes back through that membrane. When our soldiers come back with 1,000-yard stares and a party in their head, then we don't want to know about what happened to them and stuff. I think it's quite extraordinary to live in this world. And in America, this cash is just extraordinary, the amount of money that's being spent on the military.
We are the most technologically advanced military society that's ever existed, and so we're able to bring the video game to people and abstract death and destruction and familial loss and all of these things to justify this nebulous war that you're talking about.
Yeah, and this is a deeply, deeply unjust war, as is the next one that's being cooked up. And I just want people to look at the pictures and think, well, it's not a computer game. It has consequence. It has a physical effect, and it's about people. I've seen figures of 3,000 innocent civilians killed in the bombing of Afghanistan. I've seen figures of 10,000. I think it's probably up near the 10,000. And those are people who died for the country to be liberated, just like that Vietnam thing about the village had to be destroyed to be liberated. And I think the war was a revenge war, and revenge is not an intelligent emotion. It's a brutal emotion. And I think the war was fought in those terms, as is the Iraq war. It's also a revenge war. And I just want people to see that it has a consequence. I can't stop them, but I want to rub it in their faces that this is what it looks like.
Photographer Simon Norfolk. He spoke with KPFT's news reporter, Jackson Allers. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.